Hey, everybody, it's Sunny. Just dropping you a quick note before the episode starts. We're going to be doing a live Bulwark event on Thursday, October 20th at Penn Social in D.C. Charlie is taping a show. There's going to be a panel with Sarah and Amanda and Tim. I'm not going to be doing any of that fun stuff, but I will be there saying hi and, you know, letting everybody know what movies they should watch or should not watch. So if you want to come and say hi, please swing by. There's going to be a link in the email with this episode. Use that to sign up, and we'll see you there. Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Well.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, Bros bombed at the box office. Bros have woes. Woes for bros. Haha, see what I did there? Star Billy Eichner knows why. It was the Straits. The Straits did it. In a series of tweets bemoaning the critically acclaimed but ill-attended movie's disastrous $4.8 million opening, Eichner decried homophobia and lashed out at audiences who stayed home. Quote, even with glowing reviews, great Rotten Tomatoes scores, an A from CinemaScore, etc., straight people, especially in certain parts of the country, just didn't show up for Bros. And that's disappointing, but it is what it is. End quote. He tweeted. He added that everyone who isn't a homophobic weirdo should go see Bros. I mean, that's a theory. It's a theory, at least. I'm not sure it holds up to even a little bit of scrutiny. Let's just take a few things in order. Thing the first, pure comedies for adults are basically a moribund genre at the box office right now. There's a reason Confess Fletch opened day and date on about 800 screens and in homes on VOD. Rom-coms do very well on Netflix, where a $20 million comedy puts up similar numbers to a $100 million action movie, but in theaters, they are almost dead. All right. Thing the second, the numbers suggest it's not just straight audiences who didn't show up for this. And warning, I got some math coming up. I'm going to be doing some journalist math, so you be very careful here. But the weekend gross of $4.8 million or so divided by the average ticket price of $9.57 puts the total number of admissions at just over 500,000 tickets sold. But I think this actually even overstates things a little bit because the film over-indexed in New York City and Los Angeles, where tickets averaged nearly $3 more than that. So let's split the difference here and let's ballpark $11 a ticket. That averages out to 436,364 tickets sold. Now, if America's population is about 332 million and 10% of that population identifies as LGBT, there's about 33 million such individuals. And if every single one of those tickets that was sold went to an LGBT individual, and they did not, but let's just say they did, that means that roughly 98.7% of American gay people did not go to Bros this weekend. How dare they? Thing the third, the marketing on this movie made it sound like homework, like you had to show up to earn the good guy points, right? And I'm sorry, that's just not how audiences decide to go to movies. Being told you have to support something because it's a cause rather than because it's good is just box office death. Consider a different tack taken by The Woman King. All right, that's a movie that was targeting a similarly sized audience as Bros, in that case, African-American women, who comprise about 7% of the American population. And it did so by showing people a rousing action movie with, like, great action scenes and big fights and that sort of stuff, rather than just hectoring people about showing up. Shocker, that movie opened almost four times Bros gross, okay? Thing the fourth. Here's the fourth thing. I have a hard time believing that Americans have suddenly gotten more homophobic now than they were in decades past when, like, The Birdcage or Brokeback Mountain were huge box office hits. Like, even Love, Simon, which came out a couple years back, more than doubled Bros' opening weekend box office. And thing the fifth, and I feel kind of bad saying this, but I feel like he's opened himself up to it. Billy Eichner's just super annoying. Like, Billy on the street is the sort of thing that I can tolerate for about 90 seconds and not much more than that. And he was like the worst part of later seasons of Parks and Rec. Like I watched the trailers for that movie. And I think to myself, 2 hours of this, no, thank you. But it's entirely possible that I am just a horrible bigot and part of the problem. Alyssa, what's wrong with me?
I mean, there are so many things wrong with you, Sonny.
Don't take that literally, not a literal question.
Yeah, I thought this segment was about Bros.
Not
about what's wrong with Sonny.
Who here is the broiest bro on the show? I think we all know the answer to that. All right, I'm sorry. Alyssa, so what's the deal here?
Yeah, so I think that Bros ran up against a couple of the problems you've identified, but also there is just a tension between selling your thing as historic and important to a certain extent and selling it as interesting. And I actually think that as sort of an experiment and as a casting showcase, the idea behind Bros is great, right? The whole shtick is that everyone in the movie, even straight characters, is played by LGBT actors. And that is frankly a twist on the diversity debate in Hollywood that I think is refreshing and useful, right? I mean, there tends to be a reductionist argument in these cases. Only trans actors should play trans characters. Only people from a very specific racial and ethnic background should play characters from extremely specific racial and ethnic backgrounds. The more expansive thing to argue in all of these cases would be that, you know, you should cast more trans actors as cis characters. You should cast, you know, people of various races and ethnicities as not their ethnicities, because there are inevitably going to be, you know, more people in broader categories than there are in extremely narrow ones. And so for Bros to essentially sell itself within Hollywood as a sort of historic talent showcase is a much more intelligent version of that diversity argument than the one that has sort of dominated Twitter, if not places like, you know, USC Annenberg's, you know, inclusion efforts. So, you know, on a sort of like business level, I found Bros very appealing. I will say, you know, I think that the trailer, you know, leaned into that a little bit. In part, you know, the main character works at like an LGBT, is trying to like get an LGBT history museum set up. It's very, very narrow cast. And, you know, I mean, I think that there is probably a legitimate question about whether a movie that is aimed at like date night audiences that also has, you know, gay sex scenes is going to, I think there are probably still some mental hurdles there. You know, I mean, I think something like Brokeback Mountains, like you're, you know, you're there for like the trauma and the history and the high-mindedness of it all, not for the, you know, I think there are probably a fair number of American straight couples who just like aren't going to see themselves in a gay rom-com and then aren't going to pick it for date night fare. And whether that is evidence of homophobia or sort of an incomplete, you know, revolution and cultural integration, you know, tomato, tomato, you can have that argument. That's totally fair. But I think that, you know, Bros was advertised as a movie that's in part about Billy Eichner's character. And I agree with you. I like the trailer sold it as the least annoying version of Billy Eichner, but his shtick has never been one that I found that interesting. It sold it as sort of as much about his professional life in like a kind of niche LGBT space as it sold it, as the movie sold itself as a romantic comedy. And so, you know, I am eager to see Bros. I wrote approvingly about the idea for it when it was announced. Did I get around to see it opening weekend? No, because I have a lot of things going on and like I'm looking forward to seeing it at some point. But it was also sold sort of intermittently and narrowly enough that, you know, at a certain point, if your marketing for a movie is like, this is for this community, this is about this community, instead of being a more sort of straightforward argument, there are some people who, you know, in their very elementary, early, like, okay, if I'm going to see one thing this weekend, folks will filter that out. And I think it is a challenge between obeying the sort of media incentives to sell everything as historic and unique and groundbreaking in some way, and just selling something as enjoyable.
Peter, I want to hit on one thing that Alyssa touched on here with you, because I do think that this is at least part of Bros' problem, which is that, look, the three of us are movie heavy consumers. We consume a lot of movies just as a course through the course of our job, but also through our personal lives. Like it's what we
more
like
than
to do.
Most people, even before it became a gig.
More than most people. More than, and I don't think any of the. Did you go see it? See, so like none of the three of us actually went to go see it. None of us were, we did not make it a priority. It was not like a thing that we needed to do. Now, part of that, again, is because for our work, we had other things we had to prioritize. We had to sit through 3 hours of Blonde. We'll talk about that in a minute. But you know, look, I went to go see Smile this weekend instead of Bros because it looked more interesting to me. Smile cleaned up at the box office. Bros failed badly. And I do think that, you know, look, Smile pitched itself as like, here's a horror movie that can be enjoyed by all. And Bros was like, you need to see this to prove that you're a good ally. And I just think that that's just not an appeal That's not an appealing appeal.
I think that is basically correct. And, you know, it may even be correct in a way that's somewhat unfortunate. So Matt Iglesias has spent occasionally pointed out over the last 6 months or so that there is pretty good solid research at this point that shows that if you told people that that something was inequitable in the sense that like it was worse for black folks, especially for poor black folks. I think this was as I recall, this research has to do with the coronavirus, that if you told people, oh, this is actually like it's really affecting poor black communities more, then people cared less about it because the equity pitch just doesn't connect with people. Now, you might say, wait, that suggests some bad stuff about our society. But if you accept that that's like the state we're in, then what you realize is that if you want to help poor black people, you actually kind of have to emphasize the universality of the problem rather than emphasizing these problems are may affect poor black people more. And there's sort of a corollary here with Bros, which was that this was supposed to be a movie like, oh, if you want to see the gay rom-com, come to see Bros. And they didn't do a very good job of pitching this as a movie that was like, hey, this is a funny movie that you will enjoy. They pitched it as a movie that you should see because you support our political cause. And I don't think that many people go to see movies and spend a couple of hours of their entertainment time. And really, movies can be quite expensive these days. Like, I mean, it's like quite a lot, even if you're not paying for childcare. People don't think of their entertainment time and dollars as cause dollars. Now, maybe they're going to give to the Patreon or whatever, but that's a different thing. And please, you know, give us your time and your money for the cause. But it's also entertainment is a weird a message that I think just doesn't go very far with other people. I also think there's something here to the idea of representation. So I like Alyssa, really quite approve of the idea of casting every single person in this, you know, whether they're playing a gay role or a straight role or whatever, as they're all LGBT performers. I think that's great. And I think that's a good way to like sort of make the point that actually any person can play any role. At the same time, this is a movie that is very much centers the gay experience and is very much about putting that on screen. And one of the things we hear in discussions of representation is that people want to see themselves represented on screen. And that's why we need to have non-white guys as the leads in a lot of types of movies. I agree with that to some extent. People want to see themselves. At the same time, if you take that logic to its endpoint, then people are going to be less interested in not seeing themselves. And so that goes to Alyssa's point that straight couples, and again, you might even think this is like not a great thing or not a great sign for society, but straight couples, by that logic, are going to be less likely to go and see a rom-com that does not represent their experience, and in fact, kind of went out of its way to advertise that it does not represent their experience.
And I think there is a tension here that we haven't discussed, which is that, you know, I think the pitch for marriage equality specifically and sort of LGBT mainstreaming into American culture and society rested a lot on a fundamentally conservative argument that gay people are just like everyone else. Like, they want to get married, they want to have 2.5 kids and a dog and like a house in the suburbs. That the only thing that's different is, you know, who they're attracted to. And that's not, I mean, maybe that ends up being true like 100 years down the road, but there are a distinct set of queer cultural practices, institutions, you know, like community spaces, you know, traditions, histories. And there is real tension in some of these communities about losing these. You know, for example, like lesbian bars are going basically extinct in the United States. And that is a significant cultural loss, right? I mean, those were really valuable community spaces for a long time. And, you know, having something like that disappear is complicated. You know, LGBT pride go, you know, I think a lot of city organizers are torn between seeing it as, you know, making it like primarily a family friendly event and having it be something that is like specific and sexual and culturally confrontational in some ways. And, you know, so a movie like Bros was always going to be in a tricky position between selling itself as something that is set in a, you know, in a specific community setting and that something that is totally like mainstream and denatured. And I would guess from the trailer, since again, I haven't seen the movie, is that like that tension is a little bit part of the movie, right? That Billy Eichner's character is someone who is very much a product of and invested in those spaces. And the guy he falls for is someone who is like really normy and mainstream and could pass as straight. And that cultural tension is really interesting. It's a good subject for a movie. It's an important debate for these communities to be having. It also makes the marketing something like this challenging.
It's also just, but there's something else here though, Sonny, that you touched on that I just want to like get in here is, gay or straight, rom-coms are just really not doing well right now. And there is like, it's very easy to imagine a, you know, a Chris or Jason starring very conventional, like extremely white, like, classic in the sense of like Julia Roberts era style rom-com that is made perfectly and has, and just like gets great reviews and everybody and like, and just flops because it's late September in 2022 and Hollywood has absolutely no idea how to get adults to come to a movie theater to see two people kind of fall in love. And it almost like maybe the, probably with a Chris or a Jason in the main role and like, you know, whoever today's equivalent of Meg Ryan is, it would do a little better than this. At the same time, this type of movie, totally independent of the sexual politics of it, is just not something that anyone knows how to get adults to pay for at this point in time.
Well, correct me if I'm mistaken, but there's a George Clooney, Julia Roberts rom-com hitting theaters in like 2 weekends. And I swear to God, I saw the first ad for it yesterday. I was like, wait, what? That's coming. I remember hearing about that's coming out.
Yeah, I also saw my first ads for this over the weekend, and they weren't even movie trailers. And again, we go see how many movies a year?
I see three movies a week in theaters most weeks. You know, maybe two movies a week in theaters right now because there's less out. But like, I see a lot of movies in theaters. I have seen zero trailers for this. I have no idea what this movie is about. And it's because I think they just have no idea what to do with it. It's getting dumped in, you know, late September.
And look, it's going to come out in October. But look, it's a George Clooney movie. There are big stars. But that's the other thing here. I mean, you know, this is an attempt to do that without big stars as well, right? These are not, I mean, Billy Eichner is just not a household name. And George Clooney may, you know, George Clooney and Julia Roberts may, in the end, produce a hit because there is an audience for that sort of thing. So I don't want to say that it's that like any rom-com right now is guaranteed to be a failure. But the point I want to make is totally independent of whether it's about a gay couple or a straight couple, especially a movie without big stars, but even with big stars, they're just much bigger risks than they used to be because there's no sort of consistent audience for this sort of thing. And there hasn't been for several years now.
I want to make one last point, Alyssa, and correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I'm overreading the room and it doesn't really make a difference anyway. But I'll say this as somebody who I actually want to go see Bros because Judd Apatow produced it. I like Judd Apatow's movies.
Nicholas Stoller, a good director. Yeah.
And the director's a good director. And, you know, I don't hate Billy Eichner, but I do like I do find him, you know, a little annoying for extended periods of time. But like he still is like kind of an interesting screen presence. I want to go see it, but I got to be honest, I want to see it less after like getting harangued. I feel like this is a very natural human reaction. Like getting harangued about not going to see it has made me want to see it less, frankly.
Yeah, I get that. You know, it's I mean, look, when you make your movie about something other than the movie, people are going to have a reaction to that. That's reasonable. I'm not sure this is a good advertising tactic. At the same time, this is clearly a passion project for him. I feel like kind of bad that it flopped. I feel a little guilty for not making time to go see it this weekend. And like, it's, I think, you know, as an advertising strategy, this may be kind of a disaster. I just sort of feel for Billy Eichner as a human being.
Yeah. Well, he's clearly hurting. I do feel bad. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that audiences did not show up for Bros? Alyssa?
It's a non-controversy. Audiences don't show up for all sorts of things.
Peter?
It's a non-controversy. And I actually just want to say I agree with Alyssa. I don't necessarily think that the response here, you know, to blame the Straits was a productive one. At the same time, I get it. You spend years of your life on a project. You hope it will be a hit, and it's not. And that's a hard thing to go through for anyone.
It's a controversy that people didn't show up, and it's a controversy that he is throwing a fit about this because it's a bad look. It is counterproductive. You cannot harangue people into showing up for your movie. You have to give them something that appeals to them. And like being like, hey, look, the people who showed up for it really liked it. A on CinemaScore. Everyone should come see it is a much better appeal than you have all failed me and my cause. That's bad luck. Bad luck. All right. Make sure to save time for our bonus episode this Friday in which we discuss whether Hollywood can save journalism. Or maybe vice versa? ? And now on to the main event. Blonde, the new adaptation of Joyce Carol Oates' novel of the same name, about the life and times of Norma Jean Baker, a.k.a. Marilyn Monroe, who is played here by Ana de Armas. Director Andrew Dominik's movie is not really a standard biopic. It's more a Lynchian meditation on the crushing nature of fame, and it's about as fun as that sounds. There's been a lot of chatter about this movie and its supposed misogyny, the cruelty towards its subject, and yes, the movie is cruel, but only in the sense that life was cruel to Marilyn Monroe. It's a movie about a woman who was used and abused by movie executives, by presidents, by husbands, whose eternal search for a father figure culminated in suicide. Cheery. Dominik has not crafted a portrait of her successes as an artist or a businesswoman, as a philanthropist or a writer, but it's just a portrait of the indignities that were heaped upon her, starting from a young age when her insane mother nearly drove them into a firestorm, to young adulthood when she was assaulted by Daryl Zanuck on the casting couch, to her later years when she was made to perform oral sex on JFK while Secret Service agents listened outside, just outside the doors. The whole thing is just, it's a cavalcade of cruelties. That's the bottom line here. And the movie, look, the movie is successful. Blonde is successful in the sense that Dominik wants us to feel horrified. And we do, you know, hooray, I guess. It's unpleasant to watch, and that can be fine. In certain situations, art doesn't have to be pleasant. You know, a movie about wartime atrocities can be unpleasant. A movie about slavery can be unpleasant. A movie about the Holocaust can be unpleasant. But that unpleasantness has to have a deeper resonance than, like, I don't know, fame isn't worth it. Sometimes fame is bad, I guess. I don't think this movie accomplishes the depth needed to kind of put us through what it put us through. Ana de Armas is fine as Monroe, so long as you don't mind the all-American sexual icon slipping into a Cuban accent now and again. And Dominik's direction is best described as domineering. Throughout the film, he shifts aspect ratios and color palettes. You know, we're kind of going between black and white and saturated color, et cetera, et cetera. He's basically slipping between how images that he found of Marilyn Monroe looked and then using that in the film. It's a very annoying technique. I'm going to be honest with you. It's a deeply, deeply annoying technique. And the point he's making here is fairly clear. Fame was something that happened to Marilyn Monroe. We all saw her how we saw her. You know, she didn't really get to see herself how she saw herself. It's just what happened to her. It's just incredibly distracting. It's the opposite of immersive. To quote one famous movie critic, who was talking about The Godfather, it insists upon itself. I don't care for that. I don't know, guys. This is a miserable movie, but Peter, you love misery. So what am I missing here?
Well, I don't know that you're missing much. I think you just appreciate things a little bit differently than I do. I don't disagree with your assessment in a lot of ways. I do find the movie's formal inventions, however, to be worthwhile in some ways. This is a fascinating movie to just sort of as a piece of cinematic technique, and to watch all of this deployed and to sort of see it all come together is I think there's just to me there's sort of something that I even while yes finding this movie quite dark and despairing and even unpleasant. It's not like one I want to watch every, you know, every weekend. There is something enjoyable and engaging just about seeing someone who is so in control and so in command of the imagery. And Dominic is one of the, I don't know if I want to call him one of the greats of the last 20 years. At the same time, he has made some great movies. The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Ford is just a straightforwardly great film. I really loved Killing Them Softly. I am one of the few people who just finds that movie to be fantastic because it's so dark and so mean and so just like cynical about human nature and how people like do things that I just like, and about America and the American Project. I just appreciated like kind of the depths of its nastiness. Now, I think that same nastiness is present here in Blonde, and it's somewhat less effective. It's certainly less entertaining than it was in Killing Them Softly, which is really this great sort of bleakly satirical lark of a movie. I think the biggest problem with Blonde is that it doesn't have enough of a theory of Marilyn Monroe herself. The movie has a theory of the world around her, but it treats her as an object who is acted upon, and at the same time wants to criticize the world for acting upon her as if she is an object. And so to me, the problem with this movie is that it doesn't take the next step of saying of showing us who she was, or even attempting to sort of to give her a character. To the extent that she wants anything at all in this movie, it's to be a mother. And the motherhood stuff really comes off, it's kind of one note and grading, and the movie doesn't do very much with it except to say, oh, it's because she has her own issues with parentage and all of this, right? And it's her mother who abused her and that sort of thing. And I think the fatal, you know, or maybe not the fatal, but the central flaw of this movie is that its central character is not someone who the movie really cares about. The movie cares about the abuse that is heaped upon her, but it doesn't then say, and we should feel for her because she's a real person who does something, who wants these things, who has an inner life, who has a psychology outside of this very sort of one note, shallow sensibility of, you know, sort of desire to be a mother. And I don't think desire to be a mother is even necessarily like, that might be a good starting place for a psychology, but this movie barely does anything with it. So it's a fascinating technical and formal exercise. I think there's a lot that I enjoyed. I like share Dominic's sort of essentially mean-spirited view of human nature, but I also don't think the movie is engaging enough, and it in particular, it's not engaging because it's not just that there's no one to root for, it's that the central character doesn't have any drive towards anything. She's just drifting along until she very sadly dies.
I want to push back on one thing in your review here, Peter, which is that Andrew Dominic has never made a good movie. The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford is the most overpraised film of the 2000s. It's a good-looking slog, but it is a slog. And at least that movie is more interesting to me because at least it does feel like it's about something. Though it is also about fame in a weird way. It's about the warping effect fame has on people around the famous, which is interesting in and of itself. Maybe we can talk about that another time. And Killing Them Softly is like a movie that is so obvious and unsubtle as to be unartful. I just think like having it all take place during the 2008 financial crisis with the speech at the end about how, you know, America has always been I'm making a bad motion on the screen right now because I'm disappointed with that. I'm still disappointed with that dumb movie.
It's dark and funny.
It's bad.
And pointed.
It's a bad movie. It's a bad movie that thinks it's a smart movie, and that's the worst kind of movie. Bad movies I can handle. Bad movies that think they're smart movies are much worse. Alyssa.
Man, I want to be honest with listeners, that I feel like I'm still really processing what I think of this movie, which I think is, like... Yeah, I am having trouble with this one. Peter and I watched it together, which I think, and I was glad to have sort of someone else in the room there. Because it's a movie that you know, I think goes beyond sort of not being interested in its subject and kind of has contempt for it, right? And Dominic has been very clear in interviews that, like, he really doesn't care about Marilyn Monroe as, like, as anything other than, like, someone who was, like, beautiful and killed herself, right? Like, he, you know, he's been open about the fact that he, like, he doesn't think anyone, you know, watches her movies. He clearly has no interest in, like, her production company, which played a role in bringing down the studio system, or, you know, her more serious dramatic work and stuff like Bus Stop. And he just, he's totally uninterested in her. And, you know, for a movie that is about the sort of, you know, that theoretically is, like, in part about her sort of primal drive to be a mother, you know, I mean, the scenes with the, like, you know, fetuses and the, like, speculum's eye view of her during this, like, you know, episode of what's basically gynecological rape, it just, you know, and I think you don't necessarily have to be, you don't necessarily have to be interested in Marilyn Monroe as a real person, right? I mean, you could construct something about her and motherhood that is separate from her real history, which, among, like, she very much wanted to be a mother. She had severe endometriosis. She, you know, had surgery for it. She knew she had it. She, like, she, you know, she was, she did not, you know, have some sort of, oh, I, you know, I don't know why I can't get pregnant or stay pregnant. And, like, I mean, she knew she had a medical condition that makes it very hard to conceive and have children.
Which is entirely absent from the film.
Yes. Yeah.
Unless, yeah, I'm just completely missing.
No, no, totally. Completely absent from the film. And, like, you know, endometriosis has physical effects on you beyond just, like, not being able to conceive. And so you could construct something else, but, like, he just has nothing to say about, like, motherhood or the experience of pregnancy for someone who has been, like, objectified as this, you know, like, incredibly powerful but, like, sterile sex symbol, right? Like, what does it mean to be this image of, like, female sexuality and yet not be able to have a kid? You have no sense of, like, you know, clearly she's looking for a father figure in her various husbands who she calls daddy. The movie also excludes her first husband, who she married to get out of foster care when she was 16, right? Like, she literally got married so she didn't have to have another guardian. And again, like, you could be totally uninterested in the just much more complex real person that Marilyn Monroe actually was, but he just doesn't care, right? I mean, this is a movie about, like, a, you know, men who have contempt for women, and the movie just, like, I almost don't want to say that it has contempt for Marilyn Monroe or Norma Jean, because it just is so obviously uninterested in her as, like, a human being. She's just, like, she's basically an animated blow-up doll in the film. And yet, you know, in a weird way, I find myself resistant to some of the criticism of it, right? I mean, I am a little allergic to the argument that, like, oh, you know, of course, you know, that makes her just about someone who is sad that she couldn't be a mother, and that's a cliche. And it's like, actually, infertility is a huge deal for people. Like, it's, you know, it can be driving and primal. And, like, Marilyn Monroe really cared. The real Marilyn Monroe really cared about the fact that she didn't have a baby. Like, that was tragic for her and was a defining experience. And, you know, I think some of the images in the movie are beautiful, even though they're absurd, right? Like, that, you know, crazed drive up into the Hollywood Hills during the forest fire, or even that, like, ridiculous threesome sex scene that turns into Niagara Falls. It's just, like, it's ridiculous, but it's also kind of beautiful. And so, you know, I am mad at the movie in some ways. I am frustrated to a certain extent that I can't entirely get it out of my head. I hate the conversation around it to a certain extent. Totally. I feel like I'm experiencing, like, 360 degree irritation with regard to this movie.
Well, this movie is one of these movies that has been blessed by really bad criticisms. And look, I think there are, I think there are fair criticisms of this movie. I have leveled some of them. Alyssa, you have leveled some of them. But there has been, like, this weird undercurrent of, like, the very existence of this movie is, you know, a misogynistic assault on the, you know, decency of common society. But, and I'm just like, well, I mean, look, she was sad. She was clearly sad in her real life about things that were going on in this movie. Like, it's not like all of this is invented out of whole cloth. And, like, I don't think that we should say that it's impossible to portray something like this. but there are people who are like offended that this movie exists, and that is always a little bit troubling to me.
You know, it's the literary non-hotties. We just have it out for, you know.
Speaking of dumb controversies, we should, you know.
Except for the fact that that was like the most, just, it was a good Twitter cycle.
For people who are not terminally online, somebody said that Joyce Carol Oates should not have been allowed to write a book about Marilyn Monroe because Joyce Carol Oates is not hot enough to write a book about Marilyn Monroe, which then led to a whole cycle of people posting shots of, like, photos of Joyce Carol Oates when she was younger, being like, what do you mean she wasn't hot enough? And it's like, all right, we're getting into weird territory here, folks.
What
we are
even
getting into...
is hotness? Didn't Joyce Carol Oates invent the hot girl walk?
What we really need is for Joyce Carol Oates to win the Nobel Prize in Literature on Thursday to complete this news cycle. If Blonde brings that about and, like, Twitter just completely melts down as a result, I will agree that Blonde is like the greatest movie ever made for destroying social media.
So I want to bring up one more thing that I mentioned to Alyssa when we watched it together, but that I want to run by Sunny. I think this movie is interesting as a demonstration of what sort of awards bait Netflix will fund. Because Netflix isn't paying for this because they think this is like the next Red Notice, right? This is probably not going to be a big Oscar contender in the end, but when you buy a movie like this and fund it up front, that is how you are, what you are hoping from it. And it is interesting to me to see this movie following Netflix's previous black and white old Hollywood film, Mank by David Fincher, because both of them are movies about how Hollywood is terrible and abusive. And as we talked about last year around this time, during awards season, we inevitably go through a cycle of movies where Hollywood is like celebrates itself and the inspiring power of movies. And bits of which often get shoehorned into films that have nothing to do with that as like a central message, right? Like there's a whole bit in The Shape of Water about how they're watching the movies and they find themselves, you know, like they learn who they are and they become together. There's the same in the Kenneth Branagh film that came out last year, the black and white one, right? Where they watch Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and they're like, oh, this is what makes us a family, is watching the movies together. And the same in the Will Smith film that came out last year, the tennis movie, right? They all watch the movie together and that's how they become a family and feel and find themselves.
Well, I thought that was like an abusive. They had to watch the movie over and over again until they got the message of it.
But it's always about the power, the inspiring power of Hollywood to bring people together. And this year we're getting two movies that are explicitly about that. The new Sam Mendes film and the Spielberg movie, The Fablemans.
And don't forget Damien Chazelle's Babylon.
Though that looks a little more skeptical of Hollywood, I think, than...
So, which we haven't seen any of those yet, although they've started, the first two have started to screen. And it's just fascinating to me that Netflix's take on old Hollywood is that it's abusive and destroys people, and we'd like you to award us for that. And given like Netflix's very weird relationship with the studios and with the legacy Hollywood production companies, it seems like there might be some sort of not that subtle message happening.
The Ballad of Buster Scruggs also has at least two segments that are essentially deconstructions of the, you know, Hollywood cowboy myth. No, I mean, I think that is an interesting point. I hadn't really thought about that. And it is kind of funny to think about this as like Netflix's sotto voce war against the studios. Like, look at what they did to Marilyn. Look at what they did to Mank and Marilyn.
It's also an argument that is to their advantage in the sense that they're being like, the incumbents are bad. We are the future.
Yes, I actually think that is what's going on here, is that Netflix is laughing. Like, there's someone at Netflix is giving these movies green lights and going, what are the folks at Fox and Sony I guess Fox doesn't exist anymore, sadly. What are the folks at Disney and Universal thinking? And, you know, like, they're going to understand. There's like, I kind of think that they are communicating with each other through these choices here.
I also think that this is the sort of movie that Netflix gets way out over its skis on, that they're like, yeah, we should give money to auteurs to make Oscar-worthy movie. So we'll give money to Alfonso Cuarón, and we'll give money to the Coen brothers, and we'll give money to David Fincher, and they will make things that will win us awards, and that's great. And then they're like, well, what about the guy who made The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford? You know, Andrew Dominik.
Now, they already had a relationship with him because Dominik did direct a bunch of episodes of Mindhunter.
Exactly. So, you know, we've got this guy, he wants to make this movie about blah, and they're like, yeah, sure, let's give him some money. And then he comes back with this like NC-17 nightmare film, and they're like, what are we supposed to do with this? What are we supposed, you know, I don't know. It was good while it lasted. We'll see if it keeps going. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Blonde? Peter.
I give this movie a thumbs up with the proviso that it has some real flaws, and I'm not sure I ever want to watch it again.
Alyssa.
I think just purely as a, like, is this an enjoyable way to spend your time? I have to give it a thumbs down.
It's thumbs down. Thumbs down. Easy thumbs down. Not a bad movie. No one should watch it.
Why do you hate art?
That's it. That's it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for our bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch, and I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.